this morning. Thanks for the words. Anybody else? All right, who's neglected? John, you feeling okay?
Well, we came back and we keep coming back here for a long time.
Great.
So, is that good?
Yes, that's good. Jay's going on 630 straight weeks. That would make you very old, I think. In any case, to mention, Lambert's wrapping up this wonderful section we had. Oh, I should mention, Cynthia will lead us down my vision. That might be a reason since we started doing this, but I guess Preston told me that this is an Irish hymn and this is sort of a belated thing to last Wednesday. So without further ado, Lambert, it's been great having you. Remember, his eyesight's fixed now, so you can't nod off in the back row.
I can't see you either. But if you'll forgive my reading glasses, my Dean Adele, Dr. Dean Adele reading glasses today. The cataract surgery that you can get nowadays is wonderful. It takes 10 minutes is all it takes. But there's a few weeks of your eyes getting adjusted so they can give you new glasses. Now, if I take my glasses off, you're all bright and clear and sharp and colors are wonderful. It's like heaven will be. And then if I put my glasses on, I can see what to read here. I found that here's a quote this week that I couldn't resist. Ray Sedman's daily devotional is excellent and worth subscribing to, but here's a little quote from Ray. Despite all the works of God that are evident around us, both in the natural world and in the world of thought and ideas, there are really only two things that God ever does in human history. God creates and he redeems. Those are the two things. Everything in the whole universe gathers about these two. God creates and God redeems. God makes things live and God heals that which is broken. It is because God is life and God is love. He is therefore our maker and our healer. And that is what you will be if you become godly. You will learn how to live to the fullest capacity of your humanity. And you will learn how to love and to heal, to restore, to bring together, instead of to scatter and fragment and break apart. That is God-likeness. It is desirable, isn't it? Who does not want to be like this? Isn't that great? It really struck me that you can think of God as doing only two things, creating and healing. And that sums up the whole Bible in a way. Now, this is a day for your hard questions, your difficult questions on Genesis 1 to 11. But I wrote down a little list of the things that I realized that I had learned from this part of the Bible that I wouldn't know otherwise or wouldn't find out otherwise. I mentioned at the start of the class that in Genesis there are the first occurrences of things. When something is mentioned for the very first time, you put a little mark on it because it's an important theme that will go through the whole Bible.
And it was good.
And so here's my list of important things. First of all, I was thinking of all the times I've taught Genesis. This time around, it suddenly struck me of what a marvelously, eloquently written introduction it is to all of human history. How concise, how compact, and yet how you can unpack it hour upon hour and dig out things. There's just not nearly enough information on the things we'd like to know about, but on the other hand, there's enough information for us to figure out where we came from and what's wrong with the world and how it got fixed and where we're going. And all those things are here for us. We live in a very dark world full of errors and deception, and most people live by a worldview that's not the same as the biblical way of looking at reality. And so we really need the biblical way of looking at the universe and seeing it. And that comes by God's grace, and it comes through revelation. God makes invisible things known to us. He tells us things that we wouldn't find on our own, that we wouldn't ever know except by revelation. So we have a great debt to God and to this incredible book and to this tremendous introduction, because the first 11 chapters introduce the whole redemptive thread of the Bible. We're going to end up with Abraham, and after Abraham comes the nation of Israel as an illustrative representative people on the earth, and following that, the promised Messiah shows up in history. Then after that comes the church, a different group of people, a different nation, from all chosen from all people, to be representatives of the same God. And then the God who came the first time in Christ Jesus comes again to rule and to reign over the universe and to restore it completely and fix it. So that's the grand theme of the Bible. We wouldn't know what God was like except that he tells us what he's like. The revelation of God in the Bible is progressive, that he tells us a little bit here and it gradually unfolds. But we get enough right up in the beginning to understand that God is sovereign, that he can create things out of nothing, that the universe had a definite beginning. The universe isn't infinite in extent, and it hasn't been here for forever and ever. It's created out of nothing. All that comes right out of Genesis. The universe consists of two parts. It consists of an invisible world and the realm of angels. We have absolutely no knowledge of the angels except what God has told us about them. Some of you might have seen an angel, or maybe you're married to an angel or something like that, but there's this unseen vast world around us that's invisible that God created. At the same time, he created a material world. Now, isn't that interesting? Because modern science believes only in the physical world, only in the material realm, and dismisses this whole invisible realm. We find out in Genesis that man was created to live simultaneously in the physical and in the spiritual realms, unlike the animals. And that's a great privilege, because we're invited into that invisible world now by faith, and eventually we'll see the splendor of it. The invisible world of the spirits, the eternal, permanent world that's more solid than the material world, turns out. Well, Genesis 1 shows us that the universe was designed. Some very intelligent being designed the universe and then stepped down and handcrafted it. It's hand-built, handmade. This artisan built it. That's why you can't use physics very well to explain how Michelangelo did a great work of art, or why the Sistine Chapel turned out the way it did. If an artist is at work in chapter 1, and it's a highly compressed account of how the universe was built in stages, in pieces. It was built with man coming last of all. Therefore, this God of love loves the invisible and the visible world, the angels and the animals and the plants and the ecosystem, and yet the universe was created with us in mind, that God intended that man should be the ultimate place where he dwells, not in buildings and temples, but in man. And that's all up in the early part of the Bible. Marvelous disclosure in Genesis is that we were created in the image of God, male and female. That's very important. One sex alone does not give you an adequate expression of what God's like. It takes two sexes in equal balance. It's not 95% male and 5% female. It's 50-50 at least. And it takes two sexes for us to reflect what God's like, what his being is like, and the mystery of God, who's not a sexual God like the pagan gods are, but nevertheless has this giving and receiving cycle going on, the kind of cosmic dance, C.S. Lewis calls it, going on in his own being that we're invited to participate in, a great dance of opposites and union of opposites and diversity and complexity built into the universe. It's also interesting that in Genesis you get the picture that man was both created and made. There's part of you, the physical part of you, probably can be explained by a genetic code implanted in Adam. The genome that was put into Adam accounts for all the diversity and all of the variation in all of us that we see in our personalities and in our physical being. But there's that invisible side of you that's absolutely unique. Your consciousness, your spirit, your soul. That's the part, I think, that God created. One by one in every one of us. Psalm 139. Fearfully and wonderfully made. And I think that God is the one who put you together and made you this incredibly unique, one-of-a-kind human being. Loaded with gifts and potentialities. Absolutely amazing that we should be at that privileged position at the pinnacle of creation. And not only that, but God created man with the idea that man should run the universe. We're going to put us in charge of everything. pretty soon, if you get into Genesis a little bit, you start looking at the fact that the world today doesn't seem to be very much like it was when it was first created. There's no beautiful Garden of Eden around anymore. Man is not doing a very good job of running things, as you know. We pollute and destroy and corrupt and everything we put our hands on. So something went terribly wrong, as I pointed out when we were back there. If Genesis 3 had been left out of the Bible, we would be lost to try to explain how the world changed from the time it was created to what it's like right now. And that chapter there tells us where the evil that infests our race, where it came from. Came with a rebellion of the angels, the highest angel, that was probably like the prime minister of the universe, and a bunch of his co-workers were designed to have a role in regulating things in nature, a vast and unseen government over things. In that government, a rebellion came, and the highest of those angels came down into the garden and led Adam and Eve, our parents, to disobey God. God had put two limits on us, one limit on us, and that was one tree that we weren't to eat, the tree of the knowing of good and evil, which if you eat of that tree, puts you into God's throne room as it is, and you're in the library where God makes all of his executive decisions about good and evil, and we are not equipped to handle good and evil, to manage good and evil, to deal with it. That just tears us apart inside when we play God and think that we're able to run things at that ultimate level. So this is a deadly tree and God said to Adam, on the day that you eat of that tree, dying you will die. A whole process of death will set in. The other tree in the garden was excluded to man after the fall. That's the tree of life, which we meet again in the book of Revelation. It'll be in the New Jerusalem, producing the fruit for the healing of the nations and the marvelous leaves. So it's a tree that that imparts immortality and healing in some wonderful way. But we don't know much about that. There's quite a bit of detail considering the 10 generations between Adam and Noah, during which time the human race grew from two people up to billions of people. Billions. In something between 1,500 and 2,000 years, that time scale, with people living 900 years. Remember how we all marveled at that? And whatever went wrong in the fall didn't affect just Adam and Eve. It affected all of us, because we caught the disease that Adam and Eve caught, which is what makes us mortal and makes us so prone to sin, in spite of our intentions, our best intentions when we're little, our desire to not sin, we all do. And on the day a baby is born, it begins to die. And that's this disease of sin that infests the race. And you might think that sin is a minor matter, but it isn't, because the very first child born to Adam and Eve turned out to be a murderer. Killed his brother. Second child, I guess. Oldest child, isn't it? And so the consequences of what sin really did is it must have really shocked Adam and Eve as they saw their children and grandchildren coming into the world, and as they remembered what the innocence of the garden had been like, and they saw the horror of murder and rape and plunder and man's hatred for his fellow man right early within a few generations. In fact, the gospel was made known, that the love and mercy of God was preached way back even to Adam and Eve. They were given slain animal garments to cover them, to teach them about that without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness of sins. They were covered with the skins to picture for them the righteousness that comes by faith. So God's grace shows up right in the very opening part of Genesis. God's mercy, his presence. Yet the fact remains that only a very tiny handful of people in every generation seems to have responded to this grace. Make you feel a little bit more special today. That's the whole history of mankind. After billions of people fill the earth, how many people end up taking God's offer to be saved from destruction? Eight. Eight people who get on a boat, being a type or a picture of Christ, get on board, and God will take you through the storms of life and on into the new world. And so the human race has a tendency not to improve, not to evolve, not to get better, but to be a very self-destructive group of people. And the course of human life has been downhill all the way. It's been, we are not getting better. There's this myth of civilization and myth of social advancement, mostly because we've prospered so much materialistically and God has blessed us so much that we have so many modern conveniences, so many wonderful discoveries from science. But we're a long ways down the ladder of entropy towards oblivion, way late in history right now. And we're not the grand, noble people that our forefathers were. And we don't live 900 years. Of course, I'm thankful about that. Nature was affected by the fall. The universe was damaged and ruined. It began to run down. Nature began to run down. Animals started dying, and there was misery and cruelty in the animal world. We had thorns and thistles and opportunistic infections and diseases and plagues. And the natural world is all messed up, too. It's not the beautiful world. It's not garden-like. And many people would ask today, well, I can't believe in a God who allows so much suffering and mercy and misery in the world today. Well, that's not God's fault. It's our fault. That's our forefathers that brought that about. The whole theme in chapters 1 to 11 is the picture of a funnel. God's opens up a picture of the branches of the human race and shows them spreading out over the world, and then he narrows it down to pick one particular group of people through whom he's going to send a promised Messiah. And that promised Messiah was promised to Eve. And so there's, down through history, there's been tension between the seed of the woman, that's the promised Messiah, and the seed of the serpent, the seed of the enemy. And that tension is going on right now still, and we're still waiting for the final return of the seed of the woman, Eve, that will be the Savior of the world, Jesus. He's been here once before. Right after the flood, Noah and his three sons got off of the boat with all of the previous civilization, whatever it was like, gone. I don't know whether there were cities and an infrastructure of airplanes and freeways and wonderful homes and automobiles before the flood. Maybe, maybe not. Probably a very advanced civilization in a way, but not necessarily a civilized, godly nation at all. A very wicked, corrupt nation. The world had grown up. And that was all destroyed by the flood. And how perilously dependent we are on the technology we've built, so that if anything ever happened to it, we'd be resorted to plowing our backyards and planting a little crop and stealing from our neighbors probably just to survive. And maybe you've heard some of those horror stories. But nevertheless, the God of the Bible, who's constantly present in back in Genesis, is a God of mercy and grace, a God who responds to people. You don't have to know all there is to know about God. You simply have to trust him and act on what you know. And when you act on what God tells you, he gives you more light. And pretty soon you are free. And pretty soon your life takes on a whole different dimension. That's the basic message of the gospel way, way before Jesus ever came into the world. Believe what God has declared to be true and act on it. Put it into effect. If you don't act on it, you lose it. We've talked about that many times before. The world repopulated quickly after the flood, and it wasn't more than a few generations until there was an organized rebellion against God by a guy named Nimrod in Babylon, ancient Babylon, who built this great tower, ziggurat, up high as the heavens, put a pagan temple up on the top of it, and urged the human race to come together into his project. To kind of one world government, which we talked about last week, and one world religion, and a one world economy. It sounds so attractive at first until you realize that it's all built on pride and human selfishness and total rebellion against God. And God came down and saw the damage that the tower would bring to his long-term plans for mankind and our salvation. And so God changed the languages around very conveniently, so that the original language, which some scholars think was Hebrew for sure, was changed into the languages we have today, making it impossible for people to communicate very well and forcing families to spread, which was what God told Noah in the first place, is spread out and repopulate and fill the earth up again. And that's what happened. We have the hints of government, and we have the hints of nations arising, even early in Genesis. That's all explained to us. All those themes begin to unfold, and chapter 11 then closes when we get down to the man Abraham. Abraham's in the line of Shem, one of Noah's three sons, and it's in Shem that is entrusted the religious experience of the world. And Abraham, who ought to have known God, didn't, but God picked him anyway. And the next big chunk out of Genesis, which you should read tonight as your homework, would be to see this tremendous way that God called Abraham to be the father of all who believe, to be the great example of what it means to have real faith in the biblical sense of faith. And he's the father of us all who believe. And from then on, you can see how Genesis will develop and how these themes that we've seen here will continue. How clear it is here that God intended the human race to be an assembly of families. How clear it is that a man and a wife raising children is the building block of a society and a nation. How a community can't exist harmoniously unless it's built upon families working together and trusting and helping each other. Should be evidence. It's evident in Genesis. That's taken for granted as the way things are. But we live in a world that's decadent, a world full of false advertising from any number of self-interested groups that would like to destroy us or exploit us. And our refuge is found in putting our faith and trust in Jesus. Okay? Now, let's have all your hard questions and comments and rebuttals and whatever you've been thinking about during this time. You've all been reading this section daily and praying about it, and you've come to some puzzling things that I probably can't answer, but and I think we have a roving mic someplace. Okay, who has something they'd like to ask about, comment on? Oh, you get exercise.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I just want to make sure I understand correctly that you believe that the events that took place in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve were actual events that took place?
I believe they were indeed actual literal events.
And how would you answer someone who is skeptical about that?
I would say that when people are skeptical about Adam and Eve, that's such a corny Bible story, it couldn't possibly be true. There's certainly more and more biological evidence of the fact that there's only one human race genetically, and that we're all connected, and that the longevity of the human race is only thousands of years. So we come from a common ancestor. We haven't changed any. There's no evidence at all for helpful mutations in this whole time period. So I would just say that the Bible gives us this history. It's the Bible is reliable, dependable, consistent with what we do know from science. I wouldn't necessarily try to take it too far with somebody that's questioning. Anybody want to differ with me on that? Well, we got two questions here.
Just wants a K first.
Differing with you so much as saying, how could it possibly have happened that we had one man and one woman, and they had two sons, one of whom killed the other, so you only have one son? And who the heck did they mate with in order to bring forth?
Very good. Very good question. It's tagged on to a lot of little verses there in the beginning that says, and they had sons and daughters, other sons and daughters. It would appear... It would appear that the average family size was at least five. There would be a firstborn son mentioned, and then it says, and he had other sons, plural, and other daughters, plural. That's two and two, and one is five. Maybe more. If you live 900 years, you can have an awful lot of kids. The average time that you begin to have children of your own is about 100 years old. And this means by the time Adam died, how many relative ancestors did he have living on the earth, do you think? Probably as many, could have had 100,000 or a million. That's the Numbers. Therefore, Cain married a sister or a cousin. Everybody that marries is essentially, it's all marriages are incestuous in that final sense. We always marry somebody of the same big human race. Close marriage is not good for two reasons. Real close marriage to somebody is not, there are two reasons. One's genetic. There's a lot of damage now in our genome. And if you marry a close relative, it's likely that your partner will have a damaged genome. And if those two damaged genes line up, probability of birth defect. As you see in the pharaohs of Egypt and some of the kings of Spain and so on. The other reason is that it's socially very awkward for people to when intermarriage closely in a family unit happens. It's not prohibited until you get to the law of Moses. And with the early world, people spreading out fast, there's probably less of a problem when you marry somebody closely related to you. Now, Bob's got a question. Clear over here.
Dale
had a question.
Bob, we got you. You'll be next.
I just have a question. Do animals have different DNA?
Animals, that's really a great question because the genetic code differs in man from animals and from plants, and animals come in several different varieties. There are those animals that are domestic and like the association with man, chickens and roosters and cows and sheep and goats and cats and dogs. Some of those higher animals have soul life, nephesh, and they enjoy us. We have close relationship with our pets. Some of the animals are wild and live way out on the fringes, and you don't tangle with them. There was an awful program on TV this week that about a man who kept large monitor lizards in his house. Only one day they killed him and ate him up. Terrible story. So there are animals that remain wild that we've never tamed and never will.
So now they need a home for those monitors.
Yeah, they poor lizards. Did I answer it? Your
question? I just wanted a question.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
Can I follow up?
Comment? Oh, I will make a comment.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask the question right after you answered that question.
Okay.
Because I was going to tell you, I put fresh batteries in my hair this morning. I could not hear what she said.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I wanted to ask you to repeat her question.
Thank you. Okay. What was her question?
The question, Bob, was about, you know, who did the sons of Adam and Eve marry? And those were the other children of Adam and Eve. Let's go to Dell here.
There seems to be well-established evidence of super volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
And Yosemite, Yellowstone had a major supervolcano about 2.1 million years ago, another one about 1.2 million, another one about 640 million years ago, based on evidence of ash, and another supervolcano in Indonesia about 73,000 years ago, which has ash associated with it, and is generally considered to have extinguished the vast majority of the population at that time. I was wondering how you view that in your...
Okay, the question is about supervolcanoes, which we have evidence of from geology. That, for example, Yellowstone National Park is thought to be a supervolcano, and one of these days it'll take out the whole West Coast. Maybe later on this afternoon, who knows? when the angels have a role in nature's functioning. So nature stops functioning smoothly and orderly with the fall of the angels and with the fall of Adam. That means the earth becomes vulnerable to natural disasters. The invisible world is more or less chaotic. Now, after the flood, the flood covers the earth with huge amounts of water and washes away, who knows, all the landforms that were on the earth before the flood. The long-term effects of the flood go on for several hundred years, and that would include an ice age on the earth. There's plenty of evidence about a long ice age, about the European continent not being populated before about 3000 BC, something like that. the animals from the ark going out and living in various places on the earth, and then things like a comet hitting the Yucatan Peninsula and sending up a big load of ash and producing a winter that changed the climate enough to cause all the dinosaurs to become extinct. God will use judgments in nature during the end time. There, in the book of Revelation, we see a combination of natural disasters, man-made disasters, and God's direct intervention all coming in as God cleans up the world to fix it for the kingdom. So the world is somewhat unstable. Now, God's not going to let Yellowstone blow up today unless he wants it for a particular purpose. So you don't have to worry about that, because most of the time things are stable and orderly, and God is holding things that way. He holds the whole universe in his hands. Day by day, you can trust in God to keep the ecosystem pretty much together. We're not immune from disasters, earthquakes, particularly here. The Bible doesn't... when Jesus was asked about disasters, all he said was, unless you repent, you will likewise perish, all of you. And that means be ready to meet God at any time. You don't know when he's coming back. If you're ready, that's fine. He's going to take you to a grand new world.
Regarding the volcanoes, several years ago, after St. Helena blew up, prior to that, they were saying it couldn't possibly be a young Earth. It had to be an old, because all the evidence has showed that. However, the article that I read said after St. Helena exploded, they said that they had, the scientists, I don't know what group, went in and determined the ash and the layers and all of the forest laying flat, etc. And it had determined that which seemed to be old was new, or young.
This is
and from that article, I never heard anything thereafter. But to me, it proved that something that just happened could look like it happened millions of years ago.
Yeah, this is about Mount St. Helens, Bob. I went up there and visited it a year or so after the big explosion. It's just incredible how that whole area around there is devastated. But in Spirit Lake, which was filled with debris from the and ash from the volcanoes and trees, the trees have now settled and actually turned into coal and peat already at the bottom of the lake. And some of the processes that geologists thought were very slow have happened rapidly up at Mount St. Helens. Now, that's not popular with a geologist whose paycheck depends on his point of view on the age of the universe. So he's not going to admit any of this evidence. A creationist group put a book down at the Grand Canyon Museum that suggested the Grand Canyon might have been the result of a global emptying of a big lake, and it was perhaps carved out quickly, which I think is pretty reasonable. Well, that was very unpopular with the National Park, and they got that book out of there real quick. That's okay. The world system, which is under the power of a fallen angel, it doesn't find these biblical ideas popular. And so that's why your faith is oppressed along with anybody else who speaks out. Now, I don't particularly believe in defending a recent creation, though that's what I believe. I think I'd rather fight my battle on some other ground, mostly on the moral ground of how do you get your broken life fixed. Seems to me that's the place to start.
Thanks, Jane.
Well, I was going to say that on Hawaii, they have those earthquakes. It shows that those trees didn't come over just a few years after this happened.
That's very good. She pointed out that on Hawaii, where the lava flows continually almost all the time, trees come up through lava that was laid down just recently. And you can see all the vegetation coming back right up through the old lava in no time at all. The interior of the earth is heated, and we think mostly by radioactive decay, not by the gravitational compression of the original sphere of the earth. And radioactive decay heated the earlier Earth more than it's currently heating the Earth, because a lot of the short-lived radioactive elements are all gone now. They're not there. And so to have a lot of volcanic activity in earlier times was consistent with a high decay rate, breaking open the crust. The waters of the flood mostly came out of the crust. The crustal rocks still contain a lot of water, right, in their mineral structure. And the crust is also fractured. And so very small matter, energy accumulates in the plates as they gradually move. And any time those plates collide, we can have an earthquake. We live on a couple of the big earthquake faults, and they're storing up energy, and they will go zap. In the book of Revelation, at the time Jesus comes back, it says that a great earthquake will cover the whole earth, leveling all the cities on the earth and all the islands, falling in one big earthquake, biggest earthquake the world has ever seen. And that's the same earthquake that occurs in Jerusalem. Jesus has just landed on the Mount of Olives. And Jerusalem will be geographically changed radically. So on your next trip to Israel after that, you'll have a different tour bus and a different way to get there. All the topography will be changed.
Can I interject I think it's safe to say that you can't exactly determine the age of the universe from Genesis definitively. So whether you're young Earth or old Earth, we all fellowship together here as Bible believers. That God, and there's some certain, I think, non-negotiables in there, that we're created in the image of God, that there is sin that entered into the world through one man, and therefore all fell. As you say, the moral side of things, there's less certainty on some of exactly how things happened.
I think I tried to point it out that the chapter one seems to be, the creation of the universe seems to have occurred from eternity. It seems to be God speaking the universe into existence from outside of time. Now, you can't put a date on that. He's building a universe. History doesn't start until the universe is finished. Now, if you take the life of Adam, and you can follow all of his descendants all the way down to Jesus in a continuous chain. I had dinner with a young man, a young college student last night, and we simply walked back through history from Jesus into the past and made guesses as to about when Abraham lived and about when the flood occurred. And there's a consistent enough trail of genealogies that Adam didn't live too long ago. But before that, the time period of creation is indeterminate. It's eternal. So you can very well make a case for an ancient universe. Also, at some point, God had to put an appearance of age in the universe. How old was Adam when he was created? Probably a man of about maybe 30. Were there full-grown trees in the Garden of Eden? And if so, did they have tree rings in them? Did Adam have a navel? Well, we don't know. Don't know.
Hey, this reminds me, now is your chance. Who else will sit up here and take the toughest questions?
Well, we can sing our great hymn. And
actually, let me, I think I have a, on the point of death, you know, from Romans 8, it's pretty clear that the creation has fallen with man.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what the value is of understanding this now, but in a pre-fallen world, it seems like you'd have sort of an endless repopulation, say, of deer. You know, the deer would have eaten all the good flowers
mm-hmm.
in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
What would you, so is there some outlet for creation? Is it perhaps the heavens? Is there some connection to a spiritual world? Or how would you handle overpopulation of just animals?
It's quite possible that the animals were never intended to be immortal, that they were intended to live a lifetime and then die. And man was evidently intended to live 1,000 years and would have gone into another dimension at the end of that time if it hadn't been for the fall. So we're going to populate the universe, or our race is, I think. We are the most important species because God became one of us. This is his planet. In spite of all the mysteries of the universe, this is a chosen planet. The God who created the universe was born here as a baby, grew up, and died as a sacrifice for us, not for the angels, not for anything else. And he's going to come back and rule from here. And I think that means that this is the Jerusalem will be the capital city of the universe, and we'll get to go see the rest of it in due time. God willing.
Let's see.
Mine is just suggestions.
Okay.
When you said earlier that you might be teaching next week,
yeah,
what came to my mind at the time was, I'm going to suggest to you Romans 8.
Romans 8?
When John's finished with Leviticus, I would like to ask you to teach on Abraham. Thank you.
Actually, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Numbers.
Remember, before you run away, we keep hearing about the Big Bang, and because it's the Big Bang, it's scientific and all this. But somebody had to make this Big Bang, if there was such a thing. You know, they don't want to admit there was a God.
Right. The Big Bang comes close to Genesis in some ways. The Big Bang says there was a definite beginning to the universe. A certain finite number of atoms in the universe, a certain maximum time scale, all those things. But the Big Bang has no clue as to what existed before T equals zero. No clue.
Okay, we'll do the last one here.
I have to say one thing. When I took a spiritual
class
at Foothill, they had four possibilities of how the world started. And I never heard of this before. But when it said the Big Bang Theory, I said, that's it. He spoke, and it was so.
Yes? Good. Good. Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's give Lambert a warm... know that you're loved here.
Yeah.
As you see in a mirror dimly... We're going to sing Be Thou My Vision. I think appropriate.
I think one of the things that occurred to me when they asked about how do we know these things haven't eagerly existed is maybe it's years of teaching elementary and junior high kids, but I just tend to be very simplistic. If the Bible says it, then it's true. And if it's not in the Bible, then it's not. I mean, it might be, it might not be, but if it's in the Bible, it's true, and I'm not so intelligent that I can figure out what part's true and what part's not. You know, I'm not going to try to do that with God. Anyway, kind of straightforward on that. Anyway, try to hear a lot of Celtic little pipes and stuff. little Celtic pipes going on inside. They're in my head. Can you hear them?
Be thou my vision, O Lord of my heart. Not be all else to me, save that thou art. Thou my best thought, by day or by night. Waking or sleeping, thy presence my light. Be thou my wisdom, and thou my true word.
And we do, again, ask for attentive hearts these next couple of weeks as we celebrate your resurrection. And would you give us, go before us and give us the opportunity to share the hope that is in us with those who don't know you. Thank you again for Reverend Lambert and the time we have had studying this part of your word. In Jesus' name.